Avery Broderick. Avery did his PhD at Caltech, which was then 2004. Then he did a postdoc at the Harvard Smithsonian for astrophysics. And then he was a senior research associate at CETA in Toronto. And then he came here to Waterloo, where he's an associate faculty at Perimeter and a faculty at the University of Waterloo. And today he's going to tell us about the other 99%.
Thank you, Lucy. So I have to start with an apology, because apparently I stole this from Niyesh Afshorty's thesis. I got an email from him accusing me of plagiarism and threatening to stick a list. No, he sent me an email this morning saying you should check out my thesis. Of course, in his case, it was a glib reference to the fact that most of the matter in the universe is dark. And in my case, it's a glib reference to a political movement, so I think he wins. But nevertheless, I want to tell you a little bit about most of the black holes in the universe. And by those today, I really mean supermassive black holes. There are two names I want to point out here. Of course, this stuff isn't all just me. Tim Johansson, who's coming here as a postdoc this fall, and Ramesh Ryan is coming here to visit, not this week or the next week, but the week after that. So you can all talk to him about these kinds of things then. All right, so in a talk on black holes, I have to have an obligatory slide on what they are. If I put on my physicist hat, which looks shockingly similar to a Phillies hat, it's really a very simple solution to the Einstein equations. We get a metric, which up to some coordinate transformations depends upon three numbers, the mass, the spin, and the charge. And if we're astrophysicists, we throw away that one. It has some interesting dynamical consequences. You have things like horizons and ergospheres and photon orbits, something that's uniquely absent in Newtonian theories, the fact that you have an ISCO, an innermost stable circular orbit inside of which the Clairian orbits don't exist. That turns out to be quite important for appreciating phenomena. But that's for physicists. And today I'd like to do something a little bit different than talk about how we test GR. I'll have to put some of that in because it's just so damn fun. But today I want to talk about it from the perspective of an astronomer. So if I put on my astronomer's hat, black holes aren't simple at all. There's a whole bunch of stuff. A whole bunch of phenomenology, all the way from microlensing to X-ray binary states, gamma ray bursts, etc. And all of this is because these black holes that astronomers look at aren't black holes sitting all by themselves. They're interacting with stuff around them. As a consequence, it can look quite complicated. Now, far from trying to explain all of these, I'd like to explain one thing. That's potentially the most important role black holes play in astronomy, and that's its engines. Extremely powerful engines. Okay, how powerful? Well, here's a picture of 3C273. This is the prototypical quasar, the first quasar observed, and it has a luminosity on the order of 10 to the 47 Earths per second. And even that isn't as high as it goes. You can get up to something like 10 to the 48 Earths per second. Given 100,000 megawatt capacity in Canada, that's about 10 to the 30 Canadas, about 10 to the 13 suns. So 3C273 outshines not only its host galaxy, but its next best 100 friends. That's one supernova every 15 minutes, and that's one solar rest mass every month. So that's an enormous amount of power coming out of this thing. And that has truly cosmological consequences. Shapes the way galaxies are formed, evolve, how the universe structure forms throughout the universe. All right, and the zeroth order story on how you produce that is accretion. All right, I went a year and a half ago to the CN Tower, and while I promise I did not have any such urge, I'm sure there are many short people around who did have the urge to throw pennies off, budding Galileos, and had they done so, they would see the penny accelerate down as potential energy was converted to kinetic energy as the thing fell, and this is what powers black holes, essentially, except it doesn't quite work that way. If you were to do it, you'd find at some point you'd reach a terminal velocity, therefore a terminal kinetic energy. You're still tapping that gravitational potential energy as the thing falls down, but now it's just getting converted into heat. All right, and if it was a heavy enough penny, a dense enough atmosphere, and a small enough, compact enough Earth, it might even radiate. All right? So, we can estimate the efficiency of this kind of thing. You just plug in the radius of the Earth and the mass of the Earth, figure out the potential energy available to tap. You get about a billionth of the rest mass of the penny. So it's not terribly efficient. We should stick with other power generation mechanisms for now. But the thing about black holes is they're just so compact. If I plug in a kind of a characteristic size for a black hole, you quickly see that you can get out something like the total rest mass of whatever's falling on. which means you can get luminosities that are comparable to m dot c squared. Now that's a zeroth order picture. And today I want to tell you how we're going to be using fancy imaging techniques to probe accretion in detail. And that means we have to go a little bit further in how accretion works. And, you know, we have to start talking about things like how bright black holes can get and what regulates that. And the spherical cow version of that is, you know, talking about supply side and demand side economy for black holes. So on the supply side, we talk about Bondi accretion. We imagine we have a black hole sitting in some diffuse hot gas. There's some radius at which matter is bound to the black hole, some radius at which it's just thermally unbound. And you can convince yourself without too much trouble that there's an accretion rate associated with that, which goes as the density of stuff around this position times the surface area of the sphere at this point times the thermal diffusion across that sphere. All right? And that goes as m squared over t to the 3/2. Hot gas means low accretion rates. Small black holes means low accretion rates. All right? And this is really the supply, all right? How much gas a black hole can grab. On the other hand, black holes can be demand limited. As that stuff falls on, it's compressing, it's thermalizing and shining, and that means that it's emitting. And the part that emits the most is the part right down near the horizon, and that produces a highly anisotropic photon field out here where our unfortunate electron is floating around. And that results in some sort of force, some net force on the electron, which depends upon how bright that black hole is, depends upon what scattering cross-sections we talk about. In our case, it will be just the Thomson cross-section. And at some point, that becomes comparable to the gravitational force on our electron. And you can work out that at some fixed luminosity, we start to push our electron away. And that luminosity is about 10 to the 38 ergs per second for a solar mass object. And so for something like a quasar, which could be a billion solar masses or 10 billion solar masses, this can be 10 to the 48 ergs per second. This is Eddington luminosity. It plays a critical role in kind of normalizing luminosities from accreting objects in astronomy. Correspondingly, if we say that the luminosity is related to the accretion rate by some efficiency factor, say 10%, so 10% of m dot goes out as light, you end up with a limit on the accretion rate, Eddington limit on the accretion rate. And this goes linearly with the mass. And so we have a slightly different perspective here. If we were to plot accretion rate versus mass for very small masses, we would be Bondi limited. It's just limited in how much stuff it can grab. And as you go up to larger and larger masses, it can grab more and more stuff. You become Eddington limited. Okay? Put this in a form parents understand. If you try to feed babies slowly, you can get most of it in the mouth. You try to feed them quickly. At some point, you reach the point of diminishing returns, and it ends up on the wall. All right? Demand limited, supply limited. But again, that's not quite the whole story. We need at least two steps more complication. The next step is a cylindrical cow version of accretion. We've talked about how much you can grab, and at what point does the black hole kick back, but also now we need to talk about angular momentum. And the reason for that is simply that black holes, again, are small. So orbits around black holes are happening on length scales 10 to the 11, 10 to the 15 centimeters for the kinds of supermassive black holes that lie at the centers of galaxies. And that's much smaller than where the gas starts, which is out at parsecs, a few parsecs. All right. So these gas reservoirs are sitting much further out. And if they're moving even slightly, they have tremendous amounts of angular momentum. Put another way, if I look at the specific angular momentum, the angular momentum per unit mass of an object out at some radius, at this initial radius compared to the final radius, it has 100 to 10,000 times more angular momentum. So that means only the stuff that's moving almost entirely radially gets in, or stuff has to somehow get rid of angular momentum. And this is really why the story of accretion has been the story of viscosity in astrophysics, the story of transporting angular momentum outwards, taking angular momentum from stuff here and moving it outwards. Luckily, that story doesn't impact us, right? Angular momentum conservation is why we don't accrete into the sun, and I'm sure we're all very grateful for that. Nevertheless, molecular viscosity, what you might get from just molecular interactions, is way too small. This has been known for a long, long time. There are two solutions to that. One is to parameterize your ignorance. In this case, set the viscosity coefficient equal to some constant alpha, which you don't know, times some parameters that have the right units. And that works out pretty well in some cases, although you still don't have an understanding of what the what this alpha is and where it comes from. But if you look at the evolution of astrophysical theories, there's an old joke that starts with first invoke magnetic fields. Right? This is the astrophysics joke of version of the spherical cow joke. And that's what we've done here. Okay, that's where astrophysics is these days. You couple things using magnetic fields. So you can think of these in the first approximation as stretchy bands connecting stuff moving close to the black hole and therefore very rapidly on Keplerian orbits with stuff moving far from the black hole and therefore on slow Keplerian orbits. And as this differential rotation increases, you stretch it out. That pulls back on this stuff, pulls forward on that stuff, and we've gotten what we wanted, angular momentum transfer, torque on this stuff, slowing it down, allowing it to accrete at the expense of flinging stuff on the outside out. Even better, at some point reconnection takes over, these break up, and you can exponentiate. You can start again with two loops now, et cetera. And people simulate this in grand detail. Here's a picture from a simulation by John McKinney at KIPAC and soon to be at the University of Maryland that shows a turbulent, thick disk accretion simulation. And it's turbulent because of the MHD turbulence, which is driven by this magnetorotational instability. Okay, so this happens at least in calculation. And so we think that this is what drives the viscosity, but it's not entirely certain. And this brings us to the final level of complication. Not spherical accretion flows, not cylindrical accretion flows, but toroidal accretion flows, or donut accretion flows. And we can ask, why are accretion flows hot, thick or thin? As to say, why is John's simulation this big wedge? So that's not usually the picture that we have of accretion disks. And to answer that, we can look at the dynamics of some little box of fluid up off the equatorial plane. You have gravity pulling you down towards the black hole. If we're in the frame of the fluid, if we're moving around at the Keplerian velocity, we see a centrifugal force pulling it out. And then there's a pressure force pushing it largely up. And all of these balance. And so the story of how high disks are, how thick disks are, is really a story of how hot they are. Compare the pressure to the vertical component of the gravitational force, you get a relationship that gives you the height in units of the radius of the disk, how far out you are, times a ratio of the temperature to the virial temperature. So hot disks are thick. Cold disks are thin. Put another way, disks that can effectively get rid of that liberated gravitational potential energy by radiating it away have very small temperatures and therefore very small scale heights. They also tend to be very close to Keplerian and very slowly moving inward. So it's really a sequence of circular Keplerian orbits. And they have an efficiency, a luminosity that depends only upon how far in they get before they plunge, where this innermost stable circular orbit is. And importantly, independent of alpha. So that was a good parametrization. Once you plugged in that alpha, it fell out of the one thing that you cared about most, how efficiently accretion flows radiate. But there are a lot of steps to making that happen. And there are a lot of ways in which those could be broken. The first is, that gravitational potential energy comes out in the energy of those ions, the energy of protons, the massive particles. They're the ones gaining all the energy as they fall down. But the radiation is produced by electrons, by leptons. So somehow you first need to get the energy in those ions into electrons, which then need to be able to successfully radiate, and only then do you end up with this thin disk situation. If that doesn't happen for some reason, if you end up in a situation where the temperature is comparable to the virial temperature, you end up in this very thick disk regime. H is comparable to the radius of the disk. Looks like a 45-degree wedge. Very sub-Keplerian, stuff moving in very rapidly, and correspondingly low luminosities. Radiatively inefficient accretion flows. And there are a couple ways that this can happen. The first way is you could simply not get that radiation out. And this happens at very high mass accretion rates. You simply entrain all the radiation. Photons go out, but the whole thing's optically thick, and they just get carried in, advected in by the black hole. That's not the one I'm going to talk about today. What I want to talk about is Ryoff's very low m dot, inefficient accretion flows at very low mass accretion rates. And this comes about because the equilibration time scales for the different particles is very different. All of them depend on 1 over the density of particles. If I had some very fast electron zipping through a sea of electrons and protons, the time scale for it to equilibrize, to thermalize with the rest of them, certainly depends It's 1 over the density. But the timescales for equilibrating electrons, protons, and then finally electrons with protons are very different. They can be different by factors of 1,000. And the reason is simply the mass difference. It's very inefficient energy transfer when a proton whacks into an electron or vice versa because of the mass difference. So you can imagine a situation in which electrons are coupled to electrons and form something like a fluid. Protons are coupled to protons, form something like a fluid. But the electrons and the protons can just barely couple to each other or don't couple to each other very effectively. They don't equilibrate. They don't have the same temperature on a time scale comparable to the time scale that it accretes, the free fall time scale. And that gives you a condition on the mass accretion rate in units of this Eddington mass accretion rate that I mentioned before. And you find that when you're below about 1% of that Eddington rate, you simply can't move energy from the ions into the leptons. And so whatever happens over here doesn't matter, and you're stuck with a thick disk. And this is the regime that most black holes, most supermassive black holes, are actually in today. Okay? Most of them aren't accreting like gangbusters. Most of them aren't conspicuous consumers of wealthy gas reservoirs. Most of them are really this radiatively inefficient thing, so far as this story holds. Okay? And one of them that's sitting in our neighborhood, Sagittarius A star, is the black hole at the center of our galaxy. And here it is shown in the radio. It's a big white dot. That's not a dot I put on with PowerPoint. But if you look at the spectrum, okay, 6 centimeters is somewhere around here. It peaks at around 1 millimeter and then dives precipitously. And that means that the total energy, the total luminosity coming out of Sag A star, is something like 10 to the 36 ergs per second when you add it all up. And that's really tiny. I mean, that's much smaller than that 10 to the 48. And just to drive the point home that it's dim, here's a picture in the infrared. And the only reason why you know where it is because somebody put these nice yellow arrows on the plot. Otherwise, you'd have no idea where it is in comparison to the stars. Right? It really is very dim. Nevertheless, we know it's a massive black hole. And we know this because of these dynamical measurements of stars orbiting. Okay, so these are all orbiting. The closest one is about 1,000 gravitational radii from the black hole. That's a periastron of this guy, I think. And you can do the kind of Newtonian experiment of weighing the mass of the central potential. And from that, they have a mass now of about 4.3 million solar masses. And this is the best measured mass of any black hole known in the universe. Okay. Plus or minus 10% or so. But 4 million solar masses. That doesn't mean, that's not a billion solar masses. It's not 10 billion solar masses. So it's sort of a lightweight. But it's growing. Every time they go out and measure its mass, it seems to grow a little bit. So that's good. But 4 million solar masses. All right, so it is a supermassive black hole. And that means that its Eddington luminosity should be something like 10 to the 45 ergs per second, not 10 to the 36. So it's emitting at a billionth its Eddington rate. Really dim. Okay? And that means if you assume a constant efficiency, if you pretended it was efficient, it's accreting at a billionth of Eddington. So it really should be Orion. All right? This is a little bit mysterious, though. Because remember, we talked about Bondi accretion, the idea of black hole can grab a certain amount of gas in its vicinity. You can go and do, you know, look into that Bondi accretion rate for Sag A star. You look in the X-rays, you see X-ray emission from hot gas. You get a temperature for that gas, you get a density for that gas, and you can then estimate what the Bondi accretion rate is. And it turns out that at about a parsec, a tenth of a parsec, the Bondi accretion rate is something like 10 to the minus 5 solar masses per year. And so that's about 10 to the 4 times. It's 10,000 times bigger than the mass accretion rate we're estimating here. And so it's unclear exactly how you get all this gas here that in principle could be accreted, that could be captured, and somehow it doesn't get down. Unless, of course, it's very inefficient. Remember, this came from assuming that canonical 10% efficiency. Okay, so this is the best case that Sag A star is Orion. That's like the 99% of non-accreting, non-active black holes out there, and the Occupy movement has a friend in the galactic center. But there are some loose threads. Okay, and the first of these comes from polarization. I don't really want to talk about this too much, except to say that there's an interesting polarization effect that happens when you propagate polarized light through magnetized plasmas. Polarization direction rotates. And the amount it rotates depends upon wavelength. And so you can define this thing called a rotation measure. And here's a measure of that polarization angle as a function of wavelength squared. And you can see sort of a trend, if not an actual an actual line. And the rotation measure for Sagittarius star is very large, and that's related. The important bit is that that's related to the number density and magnetic field strength and size of the accreting region. So this gives you another way to try to guesstimate what the mass accretion rate is, except not out at a parsec, but down, say, around 1,000 gravitational radii. And there you get down to 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year. So already it's dropped quite a bit from the Bondi value out far away. Not so much as to be able to explain why it's so dim, but nevertheless, quite a bit. And that means that Sagittarius star has something of the messy baby in it, despite the fact that it's not bright enough to blow anything away. It's not entirely clear what's going on there. Okay. Another loose thread is the potential for other sources of luminosity, things like jets. We know they're important for a number of other radio galaxies. Why not Sagittarius star? Maybe something altogether different. The case for accretion power usually is made in the context of power density. You need a lot of luminosity coming out of a very small region. This is an original paper by Donald Lyndon Bell in which he makes this point. I can't help but notice that there's some similarities between that and the mid-19th century case for why the sun is powered by accretion too. Maybe something else. It doesn't have to be gravity's wrong, although it certainly could be. Or GR's wrong, it certainly could be. It could be something as simple as tapping the rotation energy of black holes with magnetic fields, something like this. Blanford-Nayak process, which is thought to power jets. Two more. Does this Rieff prescription even make sense? I talked a little bit about this electron-ion coupling business, why that happens slowly. That was based upon Coulomb collisions alone. Maybe there's some interesting plasma physics that can fix everything up. It's not clear. Do Rieffs make sense? That's something we need to test. How does that angular momentum transfer really work? I said it's the beginning of a joke. You invoke magnetic fields in every astrophysical theory. The end of the joke is magnetic fields are no longer required. So how does angular momentum transfer really work in that case? We really would like to have some other thing than just theoretical input on that. And finally, I can't help it. How does strong gravity really affect things down near the bottom of the potential well, down near the black hole? And there's an opportunity to answer this, because Sagittarius star, our neighborhood radiatively inefficient accreting black hole, is really next door. It's really very nearby. And that means we can talk about measuring things on horizon scales. Just to give an idea of what that entails, if we imagine backlighting a black hole, it will leave a shadow. Okay, that shadow corresponds to every photon trajectory that would have had to start near or on the horizon. All the bright ones would be things that got far, far away. This gives us kind of a typical length scale for how big horizon scale things look to us if we were to make a picture, and that's about 53 microarc seconds. In practice, of course, it's not backlit. We're looking at accretion flows, and that's what we want to study today. We want to understand what this accretion flow is doing, but it's still essentially the same scale, 53 microarc seconds. Okay. To put that in context, though, if I take the telescope that I have at home, and I have yet to actually take it out since I moved here in September, not a lot of good nights yet, is an 8-inch Dobsonian Newtonian reflector. And that means that when I look at stars, if the atmosphere cooperates, I don't see stars. I would see an Airy pattern, and the size of the Airy pattern is, of course, lambda over d, wavelength divided by the diameter of my dish or my aperture. Right? For me, that's 600,000 microarc seconds. So that's much bigger than 53. If I go use really fancy telescopes with 10-meter apertures instead of 8-inch apertures, you get down to 20,000 microarc seconds. Nevertheless, I'm always excited when I can find pictures that show the Airy patterns, because usually they clean them up. I don't know how I feel about that. Nevertheless, they really do see Airy patterns. They're really diffraction limited. If I were to imagine waiting for the next generation telescopes, the superlative generation of telescopes, overwhelmingly large telescopes, et cetera, that's a factor of 10, 2,000 microarc seconds. We're still way, way above what we need to resolve. Okay? But the answer is to be found at longer wavelengths in radio astronomy using something called radio interferometry. And here's my one slide on how this really works. You imagine some radio source way up there emits radio waves. Radio waves come by and they are detected by two radio dishes, which are, radio telescopes aren't telescopes in the sense that people think. You don't produce a nice picture. They're really photometers. They just blink on and off. They tell you how bright the thing was at the telescope. And these two telescopes see a wave that's time-shifted by an amount that depends upon the delay, and you can work out then what the average cross-correlated flux was at each telescope, and you get this phase factor. Otherwise, it's proportional to the intensity. If I have some extended source, some complicated source, and I did this experiment, I have to add up the contributions from each point, and I end up measuring something, in this cross-correlation, measuring something that's related to the Fourier transform of the image in angle. So I measured a number. This is a number that I get out of some big computer that cross-correlates signals from these two telescopes, but it's related to the Fourier transform of the image. And the important thing is it's related to the Fourier transform of the image at a scale that's lambda over the distance between them, not lambda times the aperture size. All right. And so you can imagine making Earth-sized telescopes this way. And that's what the Very Long Baseline Array is. It has radio telescopes spread throughout North America and Hawaii, and I guess Puerto Rico. And so long, very long baselines. And the good is that you really do get information on angular scales, lambda over baseline length, and not lambda over the aperture diameter. The bad is you're getting the Fourier transform of the image. And in fact, each pair of telescopes gives you one value for the Fourier transform at one point. It's kind of like trying to build an image pixel by pixel, except it's worse. You're building the Fourier transform of the image pixel by pixel. And so the name of the game is to get a bunch of these telescopes, measure these visibilities on every baseline. Every pair of telescopes gives you one of these measurements. Fill in this Fourier transform plane, fill in the pixels of the Fourier transform plane until you get a good approximation. And then you invert that Fourier transform and you get some nice, pretty image. In practice, this is difficult because you don't always get enough pixels. There are atmospheric phase fluctuations which mess up your ability to measure the full Fourier transform information. It's much easier to measure amplitudes of these visibilities than the full complex visibility. And even worse, the VLBA, as incredible as it is, won't work for us. It won't work because its resolution is within spinning distance, but still a factor of a few too big. All right, so close, but not quite. Worse than that, this is the wavelength regime in which the VLBA actually works. Around above a 7 millimeters or so. You can push it to 3, but that's really where it is. And if you look at the spectrum of Sagittarius A star, it's rising. And that's indicative of an optically thick object. Okay, so if you look at it right around a centimeter or so, you're not going to see some intricate structure from the accretion flow right around the horizon. What you're going to see is a big optically thick ball. Now, we're close. If we were to try to do the same thing with 3C273, this is right about where a millimeter is. It keeps being optically thick way up to the optical frequencies. Here, at least it turns over around a millimeter. Putting it on the same scale, this becomes really clear. Okay, if I stretch this out so the scales are roughly similar, this is still optically thick way up. So we're shy by factors of a few, factor of 10, but not much more than that. And finally, there's interstellar scattering. Sagittarius A star is very inconveniently located at the center of the galaxy, behind all the muck between us and the center of the galaxy. Again, we're within spinning distance of making that not an issue. And so really, we just need to redo the VLBA at 1 millimeter, and that's what the Event Horizon Telescope is. It's a VLBA at 1 millimeter. And we now have a new little name, new graphic. There's a website, eventhorizontelescope.org. The U.S. government paid GoDaddy.com for that, so there's something very wrong with this. Okay, so the Event Horizon Telescope. It's an Earth-sized millimeter, submillimeter VLBI array, and it consists of existing and planned telescopes, so we're not talking about plunking down new telescopes and having to pay for them. Somebody else paid for all those. We're just talking about putting them together. And there are a number of available telescopes to do that. A bunch of them are listed here. And at the end of the day, we can get to resolutions on the order of 10 microarc seconds, maybe 20 microarc seconds. Okay, so this is enough to put many resolution elements across that shadow, resolve horizon scale structure, and the accretion flow around Sagittarius A star. And I mentioned some of the reasons why you would do this at millimeter and submillimeter wavelengths, but there are two more that are worth mentioning. One is that the standard kind of techniques that they use at the VLBA and other interferometers are still usable at a millimeter, but it gets really hard if you push beyond that. And secondly, you can still see through the atmosphere pretty well. The atmosphere starts to get opaque due to water absorption below about half a millimeter. So then you start having problems there, just getting enough good weather. This has already been done. This isn't something in the future. On Hawaii, California, Arizona baselines, they have already gone through this process of measuring these visibilities, measuring the Fourier transform of that image. Here is a picture from that. They detected sub-horizon scale structure. So sub-horizon scale structure in that accretion flow. Since that time, that's been done again. And now we have four epochs of data we could talk about, all of it quite consistent with each other. And I'll talk a little bit about the analysis later. But this is getting better. So that's three stations. But there are many more than three stations on my plot. There are ways in which it's getting better, first by improving sensitivities at individual stations, but more importantly by adding sites. Okay, so adding planned sites, things like a telescope at the South Pole that already exists, ALMA, which is being built as we speak, and also potentially locating ALMA test dishes. So that involves moving steel, so that's a little bit high in the sky. We already have one. I mean, the Event Horizon Telescope already got one of these ALMA test dishes. Unfortunately, they're not putting it anywhere that's relevant for Sagittarius Star. They're putting it in Greenland, which is still useful for other things. Right. And this is really going to be an imaging experiment in the future. So here's a picture of an input image. Pretend that this is what Sagittarius Star really looked like. If I had only seven telescopes, I could produce a picture that looked kind of like that. You can see it has a big blob, but otherwise it's pretty terrible. But as I increase the number of telescopes involved, at some point it starts looking pretty faithful, pretty good. This really will be an imaging telescope. It's an imaging experiment. We're going to get a picture like this at some point. Okay. Today is not that time, though. Today, what we have is the value for the Fourier transform of the image at a handful of points in that Fourier transform plane. Everywhere you see these green points. Okay. And if we put it all together, this is what we have. Okay. So imagine having a photo and trying to reconstruct what the photo was if you only had pixels at the green points. That's where we are today. It's not so hopeless. I mean, it's not a line. It really is. It does have two-dimensional information. And we can do surprisingly much with this. But I want to make the point. I want to hammer it home that this is getting better over the next few years as we add in those additional telescopes. The number of places in this Fourier transform plane will get information is increasing dramatically. So because we have only a few points, as a theorist, I am tempted to fill in gaps in data with my personal biases. Because that sounds bad, we give it a better name, non-imaging techniques. But they're essentially choosing some model for what you think the image should look like, making a picture of it, and computing what the Event Horizon Telescope should see, and comparing at the points the Event Horizon Telescope measured something. Essentially doing analysis in that Fourier transform space. All right. There are many ways you could choose your model. It doesn't have to be just these accretion flow models that I described. And I'll show a couple examples of something else. But once you have chosen a model or a set of classes of models, there are some questions you might want to answer, things like how good is a fit, which model parameters, what's the posterior probability of a given set of model parameters given the data. And I showed four epochs of data. How consistent are they with each other? But at the same time, and perhaps more importantly, I want to compare different models. What's, how good is a given model? And there we've employed these things called information criteria. Bayesian information criterion is really a ratio of the Bayesian evidence at the end. But there are other things, like the Akaki information criterion, which relates something about the entropy and the residuals of the fit, and yet others. And you can construct from these something like a relative significance. The way that they're normally judged is on this thing called the Jeffrey scale. Differences between information criteria and two models are all that significant. And if one model has an information criterion that's smaller by 5 to 10, the smaller model, the model with the smaller information criterion is very strongly preferred. More than 10, it's conclusively preferred. This is something like 2 sigma. This is above 3 sigma. Yeah, that's really a way to think. None of this encapsulates things like Occam's razor. If I have a model that fits a lot of other data, none of the statistics here actually can account for that. That's kind of a thing missing from the statistics, I think, and worth a little bit of thought. But then again, we're reminded by Mark Twain about lies, damn lies, and statistics. What that really means when I start quibbling over Occam's razor and information criteria is that we really want better data and more of it. Okay, so fitting some models. The first model, before I get into showing you how we're learning about accretion flows, is a Gaussian blob. That's first because every compact emission region is to zeroth order a Gaussian blob. Also because they fit this originally when the first detections were made. So you stick in some blob, you worry about that interstellar scattering screen between us and the center of the galaxy because you're looking through the galaxy itself. Produce those visibilities that are observed and compare them. You get a reasonably good fit, chi-squareds, reduced chi-squareds, reasonably close to one. An important point is that all the different epochs are consistent with each other. Okay, at the one sigma level. They're all consistent with each other. There's no evidence for Sagittar having changed at all, and I'll come back to that. And here are these information criteria. Only differences matter, so we can ignore those. The next toy model you might consider is something like an asymmetric Gaussian. This is an extended object, it's an extended blob. You do much better. Okay, reduced chi-squareds now less than one. Again, all epochs are consistent with the same thing. Very clearly, it's asymmetric. Those information criteria are reduced by about 7. Very strongly prefers asymmetry. Okay. So this is the kind of game we play when we're sticking in this non-imaging technique, when we're filling gaps with data, gaps of data with theory. But now, I started talking about accretion flows, and so let's plug those in. And we have a very simplistic, semi-analytical accretion model for Sagittar. It's really just a self-similar disk with some specified run in radius for the density, temperature, et cetera. Okay, but it's a self-similar disk. It's Keplerian, which isn't right for RIAFs, but without an obvious choice for something else, it's what we went with. And ballistic inside of that innermost stable circular orbit, so stuff plunges through that. You give it a magnetic field, it has thermal electron and parallel electron components. I say thermal because remember that in these RIAF models, the electrons are not in equilibrium with the ions. Okay, they're much colder than the ions. So it's not really thermal, it's really Maxwellian. You can think of this as just a broadened, smushed electron distribution function, which is not really Maxwellian. You apply some self-absorbed synchrotron emission. So you follow rays through this plasma, and you integrate up the light to absorb what's absorbed. And at the end of the day, we have a model which is defined by 6 numbers, a couple of normalizations for our accretion flow. The structure's already set. And the spin direction is, and the spin direction. So 6 numbers, 3 normalizations, 3 components in the spin. They aren't all independent. We do have other information. We know something about Sagittar. It's not just the images that we're using. We also know about its spectral and polarization problems, properties, and so that we can fix some of these, and in fact, we fix exactly 3 of them by making sure that we fit the spectrum with high fidelity. And that means at the end of the day, we get a sequence of images which do all of the general relativistic ray tracing and all of the appropriate rate of transfer, which correspond to models which fit the spectrum, and that depend upon the spin. Also depends upon the inclination, which I didn't show. And these sets of models actually have the same number of parameters as those asymmetric Gaussians, just because they're relatively simple. And you can go ahead and fit them in exactly the same way now. Much lower reduced chi-squared, much lower information criteria. This conclusively eliminates symmetric models. It's very, very strongly preferred over the asymmetric Gaussian. All right, so physics mattered, even our very simplistic version of physics. Plugging in rotation, plugging in gravitational lensing, plugging in the structure of the accretion flow disk, even in the very simple way we did, seemed to have made things tremendously better. You might ask why. Here's this asymmetric Gaussian plot. Here, let's focus just on the visibilities. It looks like to me, and it looks like when I looked at the numbers, that the reason why this fits better is because this is broader. Okay, this is relatively narrow. And the breadth of this is dictated by the angular structure in these images. And so actually, this might have something to do with that silhouette. So we might have actually seen evidence for that already. Now, given those kinds of models, we can go and do that posterior parameter estimation. Okay, and that just means doing a little math and applying a prior. The prior we apply is an isotropic direction on the spin. In other words, we know nothing about what direction Sagittar's spin is in. And when you do that, you end up with this posterior probability distribution. I have three parameters. I have spin magnitude, inclination, so how tilted the spin is against our line of sight, and then each panel shows a different position angle, so whether it's north or pointed northwest or west on the sky. Right? And the point isn't the particular values, although we have them. I think the point is how narrowly constrained things are getting already, even with that just terribly poor coverage in that Fourier transform plane. We're already getting very narrow fingers of allowed regions. And the most likely part is hundreds of times more likely than average. Now, that's all just from those visibility magnitudes. I said that getting the magnitudes was easy, but getting the phase information was hard. But you really would like that. First, because you can't tell the difference between these two pictures on the basis of visibility magnitudes alone. If I rotate the image by 180 degrees, I get exactly the same magnitudes. That's nothing deep. That's just something about symmetries and Fourier transforms. And secondly, because image structure really is very sensitive to phase information, and David Hasselhoff is going to help me here. I actually made this slide for a talk I gave in Germany. None of the Germans laughed, but everybody else did. So imagine that I got mixed up, and I took visibility magnitudes associated with an image of the Enterprise, but visibility phases associated with the Hoff. And I tried to reconstruct an image, and what you get back is the Hoff. In other words, the amplitudes are mostly noise. Most of the information in a given image comes from the phase. And that's not because David is particularly photogenic. If I reverse the two, I get the Enterprise. Okay. So phase information really is critical. And we can look at how things are going to improve as we get phase information. Now, we can't get phase information in the way you'd like. You'd like to know what the phases of each of those visibilities is. But that's actually quite difficult. What you can get are these things called closure phases, which are just combinations of those individual visibility phases, which are insensitive to atmospheric phase errors. Good phase information. And we can illustrate how big a deal those are going to become on a plot. So here's marginalized over this position angle in the sky. So this is just spin magnitude and orientation, inclination relative to the line of sight, marginalized over the sky. So this is the same plot as that 9-panel monster that I showed a moment ago, just averaged over all the panels. Okay? And this is where we are with those visibilities only. This is if we include the one closure phase measurement that was made, 0 plus or minus 40 degrees. That's a pretty weak measurement of an angle, I think. It's really better than that. That's kind of 2 sigma-ish, but still plus or minus 20 is not so good. This is what happens if they beat that down to plus or minus 5. This is what happens if they add in one station in Chile. This is what happens if they add in 10 dishes at Alma. There's already 10 dishes at Alma. And this is what happens if they add in Alma and a large millimeter telescope in Mexico. The allowed region's right there. Can't see it's at the center of that circle. Okay, so one, I need to start doing parameter searches with much higher resolution. And two, we're going to have exquisite precision. Now, I'm not saying that our models are going to work then. We're going to be dominated by astrophysical uncertainties for sure, but there's a lot that we can begin to start talking about trying to probe.
Avery, so is theta the direction of the spin?
So this is the spin magnitude, and theta is the inclination angle of the spin vector of the black hole. Okay, so angle relative to the line of sight.
Understanding as the spin decreases, it would be increasingly difficult to measure its direction.
In reality, theta is the angular momentum vector of the accretion flow.
Ah, that's good. Okay.
Yeah. We've assumed they've aligned. Maybe that's not a good assumption, and I'll talk about that. So in the future, what are we going to be able to do with those kinds of precisions? The first thing we can do is start checking that Ryoff prescription. I said Ryoff should be thick subcapillarian disks, but thick, hot, thick disks look very different than cold, thin disks. And capillarian disks look different than subcapillarian disks. And so already we should be able to start telling the difference between these two. All right. Checking to make sure that our Ryoff models are internally consistent makes sense at all. We might also start asking questions about how angular momentum actually gets transferred. Does those magnetorotational instabilities really work? I keep showing pictures of accretion disks, things like John's accretion flow, and they're all very turbulent, but that's not what I stuck in. I stuck in this very smooth I would call it laminar, but that's a lie. It's not laminar. It's just smooth because it's convenient. There's no physical reason for it to be smooth. It should be turbulent. Okay, and that means that I should produce images that have a lot of small-scale structure. And small-scale structure in the images should affect what the visibilities are. It should affect what the Fourier transform those images look like at large wave numbers, at large distances. And you can convince yourself that those go as a power law if the turbulence is a power law. And so I should see a departure from what I might expect from my accretion flow model alone, and that departure should happen at large distances. And this is the distance range. This is the baseline range that's actually available with the Event Horizon Telescope. So we should be able to measure something about how important turbulence is, maybe even measure properties of the turbulent spectrum and the accretion flow with the Event Horizon Telescope for Sagittarius Star. We might also ask, why are all the epochs consistent? So if I look at SS-433, this is a microquasar. So this is a stellar mass black hole in our galaxy, but it's accreting like gangbusters. It's thought to be sort of like a small version, a low mass version of a quasar. And it has these outflows, but I think everybody here can see that the outflow isn't a straight line. It kind of does this little spiral thing. Why is it doing that? It does that because it precesses. Okay, so SS-433 is in a binary. There's a spin and accretion flow, orbital angular momentum in the binary. The whole thing precesses around, and it's spitting out this jet in a direction that's dependent upon the spin of the black hole or the orientation of the accretion flow or something like this. And it's just like taking the hose out and spinning it around, you end up with a spiral structure downstream. Okay, and the time scale for SS-433 to do this is actually not terribly long. So you might ask, why doesn't that happen in something like Sagittarius Star? And in fact, it should be immediately apparent, because these thick disks that we're talking about, these thick RIAFs, they don't align. Bardeen-Pedersen doesn't work on them. You don't expect them all to be in the equatorial plane. If it's misaligned far away, it should stay misaligned all the way down. So assuming the disk angular momentum and the spin are the same is maybe not a good assumption. And that means that they should precess due to any number of things, lens theorem being one, but also you could have massive stuff around it. Those guys would change the gravitational potential cause precession, or even deviations from GR, although I think you'd have to start proving these aren't the case first, of course. And the timescales for that are something like a year. But we have data covering now timescales from 10 seconds to 2 years. So we should just start being able to say whether or not Sagittarius Star is really precessing. And here's a picture of what one of those misaligned disks might look like. They look kind of different than the ones that we've looked at so far. Okay. And then there's the immediate future just got really exciting. I was talking about supply and demand. Sagittarius Star has a great deal of supply far away. Somehow it's demand limited in a way we don't understand. Well, that's about to get even worse, because there's this gas cloud, this infrared blob that's moving towards Sagittarius Star. Hot gas. There's pictures overlaid from 2002, 2007, and 2011. This gas cloud plowing towards Sagittarius Star. There's a simulation of what might happen when it gets close by. This is what it's supposed to look like next year, maybe 2014. We start seeing the tidal disruption of that gas cloud. And all the way out to past 2050, the tails will be accreting back onto Sagittarius Star. And my first reaction when I see this is, oh God, we're screwed. We better do this now, or else it's all going to be optically thick. Well, the good news is the gas cloud is 3 Earth masses. So this might change things by a factor of 2, but it's not going to change them by more than that. Okay, so we're okay. But what that means is we're going to get to see what happens when a black hole goes from being almost completely non-active to slightly more active. Measure something about the dynamic response of the accretion flow. So that's getting actually quite exciting. Okay. And in the last couple minutes, especially because Tim is coming, let me tell you how we might start testing GR. There are lots of ways that we could go after general relativistic signals, things like looking at hot spots and measuring dynamics of stuff orbiting the black hole. And there are lots of great ways to do that. But something that might be simplest is to ask what the shape of that silhouette, of that shadow does. What the shape of the accretion flow does, and ask if there are orthogonal ways in which that changes when you break general relativity to the ways that you can make it change by messing around with the astrophysics. And here we've taken a stab at doing that. Okay, so with Tim Johansson, Dimitrios Saltis, Avi and I have looked at these quasi-Kerr metrics. So the metric is given by the Kerr metric plus a perturbation. That perturbation is carefully chosen for a variety of reasons. But nevertheless, at the end of the day, you have three parameters which govern your accretion flow, or I'm sorry, your metric, in addition to charge, which we've just thrown away. You have mass, you have spin, and you have a quadrupole moment. And when general relativity is the right theory, this epsilon is zero, that quadrupole moment is just a squared. It's just related to the spin. But when you add this new term, you have a quadrupole moment that's wrong by a term linear in the coefficient. Okay, so we can mess with the spacetime, make it more prolate or more oblate spacetime. So it's kind of a low-order perturbation. In other words, wrong quadrupole spacetime. And you can go through that entire process of producing models and fitting them to the spectrum and all of that, and then try to compare them to the current Event Horizon Telescope data, the stuff that exists just today. And these are the plots you get. Here we have spin magnitude. Here we have how wrong GR is. Zero is GR. Everything else is not, okay? Prolate, oblate. And each panel shows a different orientation. We don't have to worry about which each panel does. Let's just focus on the center one. The allowed region is this swath that's around this, you know, this one line, strongly coupled between spin and non-GR. So the first thing you might say is, wow, it looks like this epsilon is somewhat degenerate with spin. That's true. That's true. There's a very clear degeneracy just in this one direction. On the other hand, you might notice that this is awfully yellow, and that's awfully red. And so the degeneracy is not perfect. So there might be a hope of measuring a non-zero epsilon. And in fact, our most preferred value is somewhere around minus 0.2. It's not GR. Of course, everything's fined easily within one sigma. So right now, it's OK. But our best fit model is non-zero epsilon. Just to give an idea of how well we're discriminating right now, this is our most likely model, our preferred model. Okay, and these are models that are half as likely on either side around spin zero. Okay, and you got to look real hard to see how these differ. I'm not sure I would believe it if I said, we have, you know, told the difference between this guy and this guy. You know, maybe not. But it gives you the idea of at least formally how discriminating things are right now. And like I said, the accretion flow stuff, this is only going to get much, much, much better. This is where we are today, kind of 1 gigahertz bandwidth, some observatories involved. This is what happens if we include phased up KARMA, and most importantly, ALMA, that one telescope in Chile. Where is the allowed region? Now we're down here. Okay, there are two bright pixels. Okay, so. And then if we include those closure phases, now there's one. All right, so GR, we're coming for you. I think it's incumbent upon us to work out all that stuff I talked about before. Work out what the astrophysical degeneracies are. Okay, and of course, if we say GR is wrong without having worked out those astrophysical degeneracies, no one would listen to us and no one should listen to us. But we're starting to get to the point where we can seriously go after that kind of thing. We can talk about trying to calibrate those out. All right, so let me give you some preliminary conclusions, because this is an ongoing, exciting experiment, and we're going to learn a lot in the future. First, most black holes are these boring kinds of black holes, these low accretion rate black holes, these RIAFs. And the good news is we have one next door. So we can study an exemplar of 99% of the black holes in the universe. That is to say, the Copernican principle strikes again, right? We're not special. However, the fact that it's a low accretion rate and its proximity, the fact that it's close, makes it possible to do something that's unique. And that is measure this sub-horizon scale structure, right? If it was accreting like gangbusters, it would be optically thick. If it was really far away, you'd never see it. Okay, so low accretion rate mixed with proximity, combined proximity, means that the Event Horizon Telescope, which now has a little logo, means that we can, you know, who made that logo? That is one of my simulations. They just did it in blue. I guess that makes a difference. I have to say, I went to a conference, and they asked me like a week before if they could use my simulation picture for that. But they had it already printed on all kinds of other things, like water bottles and stuff. So either they are the fastest organizers I've ever known, or they were asking for forgiveness. But nevertheless, I was happy to grant it. So, right, yeah. So we're able to do this incredible experiment looking at sub-horizon scale structure just because of low mass accretion rate proximity. And we're already finding, even though we're at just the very earliest stages of this experiment, that we certainly can't make an image yet, that we're able to say that these radiatively inefficient accretion flows that I've talked about, that I've sort of motivated, I wouldn't say that I've proven actually are right, work extremely well, much better than I think we have any right to have expected, surprisingly well. And in the near future, everything's going to get better, right? In the future, everything gets better. We're going to start testing internal consistency of these RIAFs, specifically things like, is it really a thick accretion flow? Is it really sub-Keplerian? Are ions and electrons weakly coupled? But also things like, does the MRI work? Okay, components of accretion flows at all M dots. That applies even for quasars. And finally, there's a hope to calibrate all of this out, and then we get into talking about things, really cool stuff, PI cool stuff, structures of space-times around black holes. And we're already starting to build the machinery to go after that, and it looks like that will be possible. All right, thank you very much.
So how much time do you need, for example, to throw away general relativity sigma 5, for example?
How much time do we need to critically probe or test general relativity?
To disprove.
Well, so I think if what we find is everything's consistent with GR, we'll have an easy time, and we will do that as soon as we measure something about accretion flows. I think if we find GR is wrong, it'll be an interesting result for a little while, and we'll spend a lot of time beating down the astrophysical systematic uncertainties. That could take a while. But in many ways, the Event Horizon Telescope, although it has Event Horizon in its name, and it does in some sense bill itself as an effort to test GR, is exploratory. Because I gave a lot of stories on how accretion works. None of them were definitive. So we really don't know, especially down right near the black hole, where all kinds of crazy things can happen. Not just crazy things we haven't thought of, crazy things people think of all the time. And we have, there's a ADAF, but there's also blank letter DAF, the alphabet DAFs. These are all accretion flow models that are subsumed in this radiatively inefficient accretion flow scheme that all apply down near the horizon. That's where they differ. So there's a lot of uncertainty in exactly what kind of accretion flows you expect to see. So I think if you ask how soon we're going to rule out GR, that depends on how fast we can run down all of the alphabet DAFs.
Simple-minded question. If you get this close to the horizon, in general relativity, you have to use coordinate time to see a black hole. So you don't actually see the horizon fall. Mm-hmm. When the star collapses, the redshift goes up exponentially fast. Mm-hmm. So what do you expect to see?
Well, we're watching the accretion flow around it. So the stuff we're seeing is actually out at beyond the innermost stable circular orbit. So this is the hot plasma, non-thermal plasma, sitting out at 6M or 10M. So we're not seeing stuff as it collapses onto the horizon, of course. Right? Once it gets inside the ISCO, it doesn't emit a whole lot before it goes away.
So how do you test
GR? Well, but you see photons. You see photons that go by the horizon.
Okay, so shadow.
That's right. The other way to do it is, you could look for signatures and dynamics of the accretion flow. Those signatures then are, of course, out at 6M, or if it's rapidly spinning down to M, but far further away. I think the real answer is looking for those photons.
No more questions.
So if the black holes was rotating faster, you'd have an easier time, right? Because you can probe. With a faster rotating black hole, the ISCO is closer. You can see more structure. You could see a quadrupole. If it's an anomalous quadrupole, if it were there. So in some sense, nature is not kind to you.
Yeah.
In this particular system. So
let me show you one picture, and maybe we'll revise that statement. There we go. Okay, this one. So remember, this is 55 microarcseconds. Okay, ideally the resolution they're going to get is going to be a beam about that big. Right now the resolution they have is a beam about that big. If we saw this, it would look essentially like a point source. When we see this, we see structure.
Oh,
so right now I'm very happy that we see structure.
So it's a trade-off.
It's something to say. Right, right. But yes, no, you're right. If it's rapidly rotating, then action happens where you know the money is, right? So then it would be nice.
I guess there's another supermassive black hole, M87, that's about the same size.
Yes, yes.
Has structure been detected on horizon scales there?
Yes.
And does it seem to also be, have people, or have you guys, does it appear to be non-spinning?
M87 is very different. So let me go back further. I'll show you a picture of M87. I had one in there. When I need to actually figure out the news. Almost. All right. There we go. There's M87. The first thing you notice with M87 is it's got a jet. So this is time. It's actually a movie. And it's showing time, I think, in months. Okay. And you see stuff moving out. This is one of these AGN jets, ultra-relativistic AGN jets. So, Lorentz factors are a few, maybe up to many tens further away. And so clearly, some significant amount of the radio emission, this is at 7 millimeters, around 7 millimeters and around even 1 millimeter then, are going to be dominated by the jet emission. So the kinds of models that we created for M87 aren't accretion flow models, they're jet models. Now, in the context of jet models, what a non-spinning black hole looks like and a spinning black hole is very different. Okay, and that's just because a spinning black hole can rapidly accelerate a jet, and a non-spinning black hole can't. You rely on the accretion flow to do that, and it's not very good at it. And so in that case, right now, the paper hasn't been submitted yet, because Shep is very busy, but right now they've compared M87 to our models, and the answer is it looks like our canonical favorite spinning jet model, and it does not look like our non-rotating jet model. But in all of those cases, we're not trying to fit M87 with one of these radiatively inefficient accretion flows. We know that there's this other component that's extraordinarily powerful. I mean, there might be a jet in Sagittarius Star. That might be what's powering it too, but at least there's no evidence for one right now. And M87 is the prototypical jet.
More questions? Okay, well, if not, before we kind of agree once more, let me remind you that there should be some post-colloquial snacks downstairs at the bistro. So let's thank everyone.